Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 10th of November. Today is the memorial service for the victims of the horrendous shooting at Fort Hood, and it brings up many questions. We're going to talk this hour about the number of professionals, and there aren't very many who are working with people in the military who have suffered from post-traumatic stress, who have problems with thinking about suicide or have committed suicide and their family members need counseling, the problems with alcoholism, substance abuse, violence, and anger. The active Army soldiers, 117 were this year reported to have committed suicide, which is up from 103 in the year 2008. And the figures I've seen show only 408 psychiatrists, military and civilian and contractors, serve about 553,000 servicemen and women. Military doctors in World War II believe that 90 days of continuous combat could turn any soldier into a psychiatric casualty, and the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have claimed more than their share of stress victims. So we'll be talking about the stress that those in Fort Hood must be feeling today. As this service will take place during the day, their family members, and all of the people who have served in Iraq or Afghanistan and have been deployed two times, three times, four times, even more than that, or those who are about to be deployed. How do we treat those people? We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour. Dr. Tracy Smith is Program Manager of the Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Clinical Team and the lead psychologist at the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital in Madison. They offer treatments for post-traumatic stress, and they serve veterans in southern Wisconsin and also in northern Illinois. She is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and her research focuses on post-traumatic stress disorder. Joining us in just a little while will also be Dr. Michelle Cornett, a clinical psychologist and suicide prevention team leader at Zablocki Veterans Medical Center. You'll recall that one of the people who was killed at Fort Hood worked at the VA as a nurse practitioner. So I'm sure they're feeling their grief as well at the VA here in Milwaukee. And she is with us as well this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I have a feeling that we'll be flooded with them this hour. Let us talk for a little while and then we'll welcome your participation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Dr. Tracy Smith, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And Dr. Cornett, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Dr. Cornett, because you lost a member of your staff last week at Fort Hood, a gentleman who worked at the VA as a nurse practitioner who was described as a big bear of a man, and I'm sure that you're facing your own grieving today.
Yes, a number of staff knew the deceased better than I did, but obviously it's a terrible tragedy and was shocking to hear that one of our own had been affected so directly.
Let's start with this number. It strikes me as unbelievable that we have so few psychiatrists and psychologists in the military treating people who have had many tours of combat. Obviously, if you're in war, you're going to face a whole set of sights that you never want to see in your whole life, and it affects so many people, and we have so few people treating them. Why is that, Dr. Smith?
Well, it's hard for me to speak directly about what they're doing in the Department of Defense. I know in the VA in particular, we've more than doubled the amount of mental health professionals that we have treating our servicemen and women that are returning from deployment. One of the issues is the number of professionals that are available for hire. So I'm not sure what's happening specifically with the Department of Defense, but I know that that's been an issue in the VA.
You've doubled since when?
Since 2006, actually.
Mm-hmm. And is that true, Dr. Cornett, at the VA in Milwaukee, too? You've seen more people in mental health professions?
Oh, absolutely. Our psychology staff alone, I believe, has increased by at least 50% since 2003.
What is it about Does the stress of war, I can't imagine that it wouldn't, I can't imagine serving in any kind of war, but does the stress of war affect almost everybody in some way? It affects your ability to cope with everything when you get back because war is such a horror, Dr. Smith?
Absolutely. I mean, most people look as though they have some of the symptoms of PTSD soon after they've been exposed to traumatic events. So one of the issues that we've looked at when we're studying who develops PTSD and who doesn't, because the rates of PTSD, well, among those who are serving in Iraq is somewhere between 12 and 20%. Which means many people who are exposed to these traumatic events don't go on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we've been looking at is what sort of makes that difference between those who go on to develop PTSD and those who don't. But if you just follow people over time and look at their symptoms without treatment, those who go on to later develop PTSD start off with more severe symptoms, and those symptoms sort of never diminish. But many people exposed to a traumatic event will immediately after the event look as though they're going to have PTSD, but over time they naturally recover.
Mm-hmm.
One of the differences we think between those who recover and those who do not are how much social support do they have from other people? Are they able to talk to other people? Are they able to share with family members or do they go and get treatment? Are they able to process that event? Those people tend to recover, and people who try to cope by avoiding thoughts and feelings of the event, by trying very hard to suppress their emotions, paradoxically, those are the people who end up developing PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cornett, I know that you authored a funding proposal resulting in the expansion of programming for returning vets and another on substance abuse treatment. What kinds of programming expansion did you see necessary, and what kinds of treatment are returning vets getting now?
Right. Well, it's important to note that it was really a number of us that were involved in contributing to RFPs that resulted in expanded programming. But really, just a variety of things. For example, we now have an OIF outreach program, which is targeted specifically toward individuals returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, and literally involves staff going out to military bases, pre-deployment and post-deployment weekends to educate military personnel about the services, the benefits, and the healthcare services that are available in the VA system. That's been a very big change. And I think really across the board, I work most specifically in the area of suicide prevention, and there's also been a tremendous expansion not only locally but nationally in terms of what we're doing to address the issue of suicide risk in veterans.
Mm-hmm. What impact, the other questions that we have, we don't know too much about this major yet. Those stories are just starting to get to come in, but it seems likely that this tragedy last week will have at least open the conversation and perhaps have a profound impact on how we help mental health providers, if we need to provide more of them, if we need a place for them to go to handle their own stress. It's got to be very difficult if you're dealing with some 10 patients a day, as some are, who have experienced extraordinary stress and have seen horrendous sights. How do we help the mental health providers?
Michelle, would you like me to speak to that?
Sure.
We call this secondary traumatization, that is trauma from dealing with the people who had primary trauma. And it is an issue. One of the things that we're doing in Madison is we have a weekly team meeting, and that's part of what we discuss. I ask my team members in particular to check in with me about what kind of cases they think they can do well with. For example, one team member says, you know, I can do a few cases of military sexual trauma, but I don't want to do all of those because it's stressful,
mm-hmm.
right? So part of it is just being aware of how much stress you can handle, what kind of cases you're a good fit for, and really getting the support of other professionals. I mean, sometimes after a particularly difficult case, it's important to go and talk to another person and say, wow, I just had this session that was very difficult and, you know, I need to talk about it.
The reports that I have read, and let me quote this directly, I think it was from the New York Times, mental health evaluations for therapists themselves are virtually non-existent.
Well, it's actually, at least in the VA, we wouldn't be allowed to do that as part of a hiring process. I mean, there's employee processes in place that protect individual rights. But I think that when we're interviewing people, you have a sense of how people are doing. Certainly, you don't know everything about them. And I'm not sure how best to answer that concern.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to take that one on, Dr. Cornett?
Well, I think I have a similar sort of response. You know, there are personal privacy, you know, rights at play, and I do think I haven't heard all the latest coverage regarding the suspect, but it does seem like by looking into one's work history and in the process of, you know, a thorough interview, one could glean the needed information.
And what about those who are in the mental health professions who are suffering that kind of secondary stress because of the horrendous stories that they have heard and maybe are also fearful of their own deployment or redeployment to places like Iraq and Afghanistan? Where do they go to talk to someone?
Well, I think that's often a challenge because they have sort of a double bind, right? There's the bind of protecting your career as well as, you know, how do you take care of yourself so that you can do a good job of taking care of your patients? In a system like the VA, you can go and speak to the employee counseling staff, which is confidential counseling. I'm not sure what the Department of Defense has set up for their employees, but it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's always the private sector.
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
Have access to civilian services, so would any federal employee.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests, and here's how you reach us. Our number is 1-800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org for you to join the conversation. The memorial service for the victims of the shooting at Fort Hood taking place today, and we're looking at the issues that Army soldiers face before they are deployed, what the effects are. We have yet to talk about this, of multiple deployments on the mental health of soldiers. What about the people who are doing the counseling themselves? If they feel stress, what access do they have to help? We'll welcome your phone calls in just a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, the author of Smart by Nature, Schooling for Sustainability. So we welcome you to listen to that conversation, hour number two. Our guest this hour, Dr. Michelle Cornett, clinical psychologist and suicide prevention team leader at the Zablocki VA Medical Center, assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine, and with the Injury Research Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin, also clinical assistant professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Dr. Tracy Smith is also with us, program manager of the Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Clinical Team and the lead psychologist at the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital in Madison. They offer treatment for post-traumatic stress, and we're welcoming phone calls for both of them. Our number is 800-486-8655. As the phone calls are coming in, doctors, let me ask you about the effects on our well-being of multiple tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. How much can the average soldier take?
It's hard to answer a question about the average soldier, partially because of the statistics I gave you earlier that some 12 to 20% end up with PTSD. It looks as though about 30% or 34% who come back have some sort of mental health problem. So it could be that they suffer from depression for some amount of time. There is a linear relationship between the amount of trauma that you are exposed to and the development of PTSD. So the more trauma you are exposed to, the more likely you are to develop PTSD. But I think there's also a lot of social issues outside of exposure to trauma that make it difficult for our servicemen and women who have multiple deployments, because each time they get deployed, their family life gets disrupted, their work life gets disrupted, right? There's a lot of other changes
sure.
that occur.
Mm-hmm. And what about a stigma of seeking help? Is there still a stigma, Dr. Cornett, or not?
Absolutely. In fact, when you asked the question earlier about help seeking for mental health professionals, I was thinking about the issue of stigma and mental health. This is an issue that's still a very big problem in our society at large, and perhaps even more so in the military, although it's encouraging that there's been some change. There have been some real targeted efforts in the past year in particular to address suicide risk among active military personnel. And my sense is there's a lot of variability by unit in terms of how much mental health treatment seeking is encouraged. But absolutely, it's a culture that reinforces physical toughness and resilience, and historically has not been one that has been as encouraging of treatment seeking, particularly for mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls. Our lines are filled right now. Mike from Hudson. Hi, Mike.
Hi. See, I'm a psychologist, an outpatient psychologist, and I have some experience treating service people with PTSD, and a couple big concerns that I have that these guys tell me are, first of all, when they return from their tours, they are put in a room with all their peers, and it's in that context that they're asked if they're experiencing symptoms of PTSD. And so there's tremendous peer pressure not to endorse those symptoms. The second thing is that when one of them does go into the VA to get an assessment, what it seems to me happens is that it's very, very rare that the diagnosis is made, because I'm just assuming that it costs to treat it. And then the problem is the insurance that the VA provides for the servicemen does not allow them to get an outside objective assessment on their own. It does not pay for it. They have to pay for it out of pocket. And so most of those people go away just thinking they're nuts. These are just, it's all in their head. They're crazy. They don't really have PTSD. And so it's a terrible bind, and it's really outrageous. So these guys go around, many of them, just thinking that they're the problem.
Dr. Smith, you want to start?
Sure. He's absolutely right that there is a bind in terms of when people come back. They are assessed often by paper and pencil questionnaire. And if they admit that they're having some sort of mental health problem, they're actually delayed in terms of when they'll go home, because they need to then get an assessment by a mental health professional. So that part is true, and I think it's a bind for servicemen and women when they come back. In terms of rates of PTSD and whether people are assessed with PTSD, I can speak about what happens at my own VA, because I manage that particular program. The rates of PTSD that we see are similar to the national averages that are being reported in the research literature. So I don't think it's that people with PTSD are not given the diagnosis. And, of course, all the people that make it to my clinic, just about all of them have a diagnosis of PTSD. And we treat people, even if they're close to meeting the diagnosis for PTSD, because it looks like there's not all that much difference in terms of their functioning level, whether you're on one side or another of the diagnosis. So we treat lots of people for PTSD now, and we have very good treatments that are effective. The treatments are difficult, so it's often, and maybe this other psychologist could speak to this as well, it's often difficult to get people to come to treatment and finish the treatment, because part of what treatment asks you to do is talk about your most traumatic events.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I only have this is only anecdotal data, but the service people that I've seen, it has been crystal clear that they have PTSD,
mm-hmm.
and they have many of them that I see have been turned away by the VA in Minneapolis and told that's not the case. And it's just you know, any reasonably competent psychologist, this would be just a no-brainer. And so, you know, the bind for these guys is that they're stuck within the VA. Unlike just a regular citizen of the country who can go to a different provider, get a second opinion, they cannot do that outside that system unless they pay for it out of their pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a closed, captive system.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Do you want to comment on that, Dr. Cornett? And also, is there a great disparity among services when you go from VA to VA in the country?
Okay. Right. Well, I can certainly speak to what things are like at our facility, and I would, I guess, consistent with Dr. Smith, I don't think at our facility PTSD is underdiagnosed at all. And I know that individuals who are, say, sub-threshold for a formal PTSD diagnosis are certainly still offered treatment. I would say, you know, a large proportion of our clinical staff treat people with PTSD and related symptoms. So I can't speak to what's happening at another facility, but certainly here a large number of people are being treated with that diagnosis or with sub-threshold symptoms.
Mm-hmm. And the treatment for PTSD would be talk therapy. Is there drugs involved in treatment as well, Dr. Smith?
Yes, absolutely. There's both drug therapy, medications, and psychotherapy, or what you'd call talk therapy. Both can be effective in terms of reducing symptoms. The research literature suggests, however, that medication is more adjunctive. It's good at controlling some of the symptoms. But someone who completes a course of these newer PTSD treatments, somewhere between 50 to 75% of them are likely to recover from their PTSD. That doesn't mean they don't have any symptoms at all, but they regain a lot of their functioning. They're able to sleep better. Their relationships improve. They're less angry, those kinds of things. And those gains are maintained, so it doesn't look as though people get better and then revert back.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Bill from Toma. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you doing today?
All right, Bill, how are you?
I'm doing good. First thing I want to say is that I think the VA does an excellent job in what they do and try to do within their budgets that they have set up by Congress. And I've been in the military for 30 years. And I think that the VA is a wonderful organization. As far as the PTSD goes, I think that it's been around as long as war has been around, for thousands and thousands of years. It's just that since Vietnam and going forward, it's been more recognized. I mean, you take somebody out of their home situation and send them someplace else, they're going to be depressed. They're going to have that longing for home and for family and all those things that they don't have while they're away at war. And it's a more recognized thing, and I think the thresholds for recognizing it have probably become the standards for, you know, people thinking that they've got a problem have come down so that more people are being recognized as having problems from being away
right.
from home.
And that...
I think that most everyone that comes back from Iraq, Afghanistan, Kosovo, wherever they may be stationed, they're going to have that depression and those anxieties. And when they leave that situation and come back, they're coming home to situations that they're not sure that everything's going to be the way that it was, and it certainly can never be
mm-hmm.
back to the way that it was.
Dr. Cornett, you want to respond?
Well, Dr. Smith can correct me if I've got this wrong, but
okay.
I think the PTSD diagnosis actually didn't come into being until about the 80s.
Mm.
So absolutely, your point is well taken that I suspect... PTSD has been around for a very long time, but wasn't formally recognized as such until more recent years.
Actually, every war it got called something different. So in the
right.
Civil War, they called it soldier's heart
mm-hmm.
because there are a lot of cardiovascular anomalies that often go along with PTSD. But if you look way back in Homer's descriptions of Achilles' loss of his friend, he had many of the symptoms of what we would now call PTSD.
Yeah.
So he's absolutely right. It gets rediscovered and called different things in different wars.
I like the description of soldier's heart because that encompasses so much, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
A wounded heart. Yeah.
And I think it's often hardest for the servicemen and women who go in most committed to the mission, the military mission, who really have a strong desire to serve their country, because they're often disillusioned by the realities of war, and it really shakes up their worldview.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cornett, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I think you were about to say something.
That's okay. I was just going to comment that what's also been obviously just very important has been the recognition of this as a mental health issue that is amenable to treatment.
Right.
And I think that's been a huge change in the past 20 to 30 years.
Tell me, Dr. Cornett, let's start with you. I think about those people who were in that room when the shooting took place and who were wounded or who survived, and just the atmosphere on that base. It's a military, and it's a huge, huge place, and it's supposed to be a place where you feel protected, not to have this kind of horror take place. What about the people who witnessed all of this or who even live on that base? How do you counsel them? How many of them will need, I would think almost all of them will need, some kind of counseling to move on?
Right. I'm reminded when when you talk about it being a safe place to what, individuals who were in and around 9/11 must have experienced.
Right.
And lots of sorts of tragedies that occur outside of a war zone. That's a complicated question, and I think, individuals respond very differently to different types of trauma. I think the most important thing is to make services available to try to break down the stigma of mental health issues and try to offer services for individuals. As Dr. Smith pointed out, many of those individuals will likely have short-term symptoms which will recover on their own. Some likely will go on to develop full-blown PTSD. I think the most important thing is to ensure that empirically supported treatments are available to those individuals.
Let's go to Mike from Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Excuse me for observing the elephant in the living room, but we're suggesting that people address PTSD by going to seek mental health counseling. The actual psychiatrist who administered the counseling is the actual shooter here that shot all the people.
Right.
I'm a little disturbed with the framework of this discussion. This, I think, you're connecting it to the shooting at the base there. The topic has more to do with a Muslim extremist who worked his way into the army, became a military officer, became a psychiatrist, had been identified throughout the process, at least for some period of time, as someone who had anti-American military feelings. We shouldn't be in the Middle East. Yet somehow his superiors, his coworkers, allowed him to function in that capacity to counsel people returning with PTSD. Not only shouldn't he have been counseling these people, he shouldn't have been a military officer, he should have been removed. I'm wondering how the guests would confront a coworker who had similar feelings. Would you say something to someone? Would he be removed? What is going on here?
All right, Dr. Smith, you want to start?
Sure. I mean, if I was concerned about any of my coworkers, my first step would always be to try and address it with him or her. Whether that would have been fruitful in this case, I have no idea. But the next step is to take it up the chain. I've read the same news reports that you have, and there are a number of things in there that are very concerning. It sounds like some people were concerned about this gentleman. And, it was addressed in some way, but clearly he wasn't, he was allowed to continue to practice. So it's a very difficult situation, and I think it's often hard to predict what people are going to do.
Dr. Cornett?
My response would be similar. I mean, I think, you address it with the individual. If that's not effective, you address it with a superior. It is hard to know, who might have tried to alert individuals in the system and what the response was or was not, but obviously he was allowed to continue practicing.
Yeah. We did, I mean, there obviously is going to be a congressional hearings are starting on this next week, so we don't know all the details yet to see if anybody was alerted and if there was a breakdown in communication within the Army. But the other thing, the other news report that came out was perhaps he was allowed to fall through the cracks here because the Army has such a need of people in his profession that they were willing to overlook some aberrant behavior.
Well, I think that, I mean, we're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place, right? I mean, on one hand, we're saying there's not enough mental health professionals to treat our servicemen and women. And, you know, here's someone who's trying to get out, who's been trained by the military to, you know, perform those duties. So I can understand why, you know, the push would be to keep somebody in.
Right. Let's go to Tommy from La Crosse. Hi, Tommy.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Basically, I was going back to how when you guys were speaking of different VA facilities and how they function and how veterans receive their care and if there's any true difference. I just recently moved out from Seattle, Washington during the summer, and I'm currently actually heading to a VA appointment sitting in a parking lot at the VA over in Tacoma, and I currently live in La Crosse. Anywho, ever since I've moved to Wisconsin, there has been a significant difference in patient care, and they have been great advocacy for all my needs and really trying to be there for everything that I need. While I was in Seattle, and after I left active duty, I was also stationed at Fort Hood. After I left, there was no talk of PTSD. There's no real screening. PTSD treatment from the VA actually happened because I lost my job due to stress, kind of was in a downfall. You know, then I had a friend recommended I go to the VA in Seattle. That's when PTSD and everything came about. Other than that, I was never given an option via the military.
And tell me about your service, Tommy. Where were you? What were you engaged in?
I was a combat medic, and I was over in Iraq, and this was during the time when Saddam was captured, and he was actually on air. Well, I don't know if I can say this on air, but there's some stuff, you know, that was going on, and it was interesting because similar to the psychiatrist, being a medic, we pretty much did all, took care of all medical aspects of a soldier firsthand. So we would either talk to them as a psychologist, ask them how they're doing as far as their welfare, from dental issues to, I don't know, blisters. And, you know, a lot of stories would first originate from, you know, guys, buddies to buddies. Hey, you know, this is what happened today. This is what happened, you know, yada, yada. Be right. Careful when you go down this road. And some of that would spike a little bit of PTSD or some fear in soldiers, I noticed.
Oh, I'm sure that it would. Who wants to respond? Well, let's get response from both of you.
I think there are differences between VA facilities, and some of it is where you enter the system. One of the things that we're doing in our particular district that Dr. Cornett and I are both in is we've set up what we call a telemental health network so that even at the smallest community-based outpatient clinics, we are able to have PTSD specialists that are trained in these evidence-based treatments who can connect with veterans over video teleconference in a secure way. So you can actually do psychotherapy with people over this system, and they don't have to be close to the parent facility to get state-of-the-art PTSD care. So one of the things that we're trying to do, and Secretary Shinseki, our new leader of the VA, is his goal is to sort of bring the VA up to the 21st century. And part of how we're trying to do that is to even out all our services across the VA and how that's delivered so that it's more convenient for the veteran, so it's not based on your geographical location.
Dr. Cornett?
Yeah, and I think in some ways...
Your phone is real soft. Can you speak up just a little?
Certainly. I think in some ways, there, you know, one would expect differences across facilities in some ways, there's probably more consistency within the VA system than across lots of other sorts of hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
There is a fair amount of consistency in terms of the types of programs that are offered, but certainly you have, you know, different staff, different leadership, sometimes different administrative structures at different hospitals, and that certainly impacts the way that care is delivered.
One of the things that's recently happened is, I'm not sure, it was a couple years ago, maybe Dr. Cornett knows, but the we were funded under a system called the Uniform Mental Services Act,
mm-hmm.
and so now each VA facility is mandated to offer certain kinds of treatments, and those are driven by the size of the facility. So at a smaller community-based outpatient clinic, certain kinds of care will be offered, but others might be offered over telemental health, for example. But it's now mandated that you're able to offer these sorts of services at different facilities. So, and our central office checks, have you hired these people? What's the delay in hiring? Are you offering these services? How are you offering these services? So Dr. Cornett is correct in terms of evenness. We're probably more even than other health
right.
systems.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Tommy. Best of luck to you, and thanks for calling. We go next to Ellen. Oh, Ellen is not there anymore. Let me give you our number, 800-486-8655. Blanche from Madison. Hi, Blanche.
Hi. I'm wondering what happens to these people after they're considered in much better shape if they're redeployed or about to be redeployed.
Would you like me to speak to that?
Whoever would like to. Yeah,
okay.
Go right ahead.
It varies a lot by service personnel. One of the things that surprised me when I started working for the VA is I would say that I have about equal numbers of people who say to me, you know, I'm coming for PTSD treatment, but I want to make sure this doesn't affect my ability to redeploy. And then I've had other people who say to me, I have PTSD and I want to make sure I don't get deployed. So part of it is whether the service man or woman himself wants to be deployed and whether they re-sign up or not. I think it varies a lot by what kind of job you have, your likelihood of being called up again. But again, the VA system is a separate system from the Department of Defense, so it's sort of hard for us to answer some of these questions.
So what do you make of the reports that I have read that you could be diagnosed with PTSD and still be redeployed?
That's true.
That is true.
Yes.
So you can have this and still...
Correct.
Going to battle again.
Yep.
Well, that's problematic, don't you think?
It is problematic, and it comes down to a level of what is that individual man or woman's functioning level like? How affected by their PTSD are they? And do they or do they not want to be redeployed?
Right.
Well, and if they're redeployed, they may, again, have a lot of the same symptoms.
Right, unless they get treatment. I mean, I've had some people who are successfully treated and they decide to be redeployed, and I think they're then in better shape to handle the stresses of war. I wouldn't say it's completely protective.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. We'll take more of your calls in a moment. On this day that the memorial service will take place at Fort Hood, we're talking about the mental health services that the Army provides. We have talked a little bit, although the stories are still coming in, so we don't have a complete profile. We'll probably look more at this next week after the congressional hearings begin as to what actually happened with the major who committed these horrendous acts. But a lot has come up concerning the treatment of people in the Army, the redeployment, the suicide rates, the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, the number of counselors available to the Army being pretty low, and how people can become, we're spending a little time on this, who are obviously troubled, why aren't they just out? You know, if you're troubled, it's probably best that being redeployed isn't going to do you any good. And if you're troubled, you shouldn't be a psychiatrist in the Army. So we're looking at those issues and welcoming your phone calls. Our number and lines are open completely right now, 800-486-8655. Our guests are from Milwaukee and Madison. Dr. Michelle Cornett is from Milwaukee, clinical psychologist and suicide prevention team leader at the Zablocki VA Medical Center. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine and with the Injury Research Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She co-authored a funded proposal resulting in expansion of programming for returning veterans and another on substance abuse treatment. Dr. Tracy Smith, program manager of the Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Clinical Team and the lead psychologist at the William Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital in Madison, also assistant professor of psychiatry at UW-Madison. Her research focuses on post-traumatic stress disorder. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Following the news from National Public Radio, the second hour of our program today, the author of Smart by Nature, Schooling for Sustainability. It looks at schools all over the United States doing very interesting things in terms of the design and building of the buildings that are quite green, fresh farm produce coming into the lunchrooms of children who are attending schools, and beyond. So gardens right next to the schools. We'll be talking with the author of that book, our number two of our show. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we go next to Amber from Madison. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
Wanted to ask the psychiatrist on your program a question that actually relates to one of the earlier callers and also to the to one of your earlier callers, which is this. I think that, you know, where the media often has, raised this question about the psychiatrist at Fort Hood having been a Muslim extremist. But I'm wondering whether, as he became more and more traumatized by the stories he was hearing from folks who were coming back from Iraq, and as he lost his mother and had other, you know, variously challenging things happening in his life, whether his turn to religion may have actually been an expression of his emerging traumatization, his own troubles. And so I'm wondering whether they could speak to the possibility that this person didn't start out as some sort of an extremist trying to infiltrate the military, but as he became more and more stressed, turned to religion as a place of comfort.
Dr. Smith, you want to start?
Sure. You know, that's sort of out of my field, so I would hate to speculate about that. Certainly, if you believe the newspaper reports, there were many, many things that contributed to him being very stressed in addition to his work, like both his parents dying. Sounds like he also had a strong desire to be married and was frustrated by that, so sounded like he was feeling alienated. You know, I wouldn't want to make a guess in terms of his turn to religion because that's not something that I, you know, it's out of my expertise.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an unfolding story in many ways, and that obviously people who have a good understanding of all of this will form profiles of him that will take some time, don't you think, to develop. We don't know.
Absolutely, and it could be that turning to religion was a solace for him, and it could have prevented him from having a breakdown earlier. It's hard to say.
Right. It's an interesting point. Thank you, Amber. I'm sure a future program will relate just to that. Sharon from Duluth. Hi.
Hi. One fellow started out his comment about not speaking to the elephant in the room. My thought about the elephant in the room is that, you know, except for maybe a percentage of a fraction of human beings, it's unnatural for us to go and kill each other. And it's hard for me to imagine people coming out of these situations not having a heavy, heavy, as you said earlier, burden on their heart and in their minds. And I think it just speaks to how wrong war is mm-hmm. for the human being, how bad it is for the human being.
I agree. I mean, there's a very interesting book written by a psychologist who also taught at West Point, and it's called On Killing. And I was very struck by a chart that he had in that book, which it looked at rates of PTSD in relation to proximity to the victim, right? So if you're an airplane pilot and you drop bombs, you rarely develop PTSD. But if you bayonet someone, your chances of getting PTSD are, you know, I'm
Who
not
is
sure
that author?
The magnitude, but much, much greater.
Who mm-hmm. is that author? Is that Basovich?
No. Oh. I'm blanking on the name right now, but it's a wonderful...
If it comes to you, say it on the air and I'll
sure.
write it down.
Sure. I'll look it up while we're talking.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank Bye. You, Sharon. Mm-hmm. You want to comment on this? I'd like to hear your comments, Dr. Cornett.
Well, I certainly would agree that you know, the vast majority of individuals, you know, killing is something very foreign to them. Some of the work that we're involved in here, some of the research on suicide risk actually suggests that being exposed to situations that involve death and violence might cause someone to become more vulnerable to engaging those behaviors, in terms of suicide attempts.
And what about violence? I know that both of you are dealing with this, that one of the problems that some soldiers are dealing with and their family members are is violence. Is it also true that the closer you are exposed to witnessing violence or having to have as your job killing somebody else in fairly close proximity, does that add to a violent streak for some people when they come home? Can you tell me about that relationship?
I think that it can. I couldn't give you numbers on that, but I think, you know, some of what we're looking at is whether exposure to violent combat-type situations might kind of lower the threshold and habituate someone psychologically and make you more likely to engage in those behaviors yourself. But obviously, there's tremendous variability. As Dr. Smith pointed out, some people return from a war zone, have a relatively short period of difficulty, and then they seem to adjust fairly well. That answers your question.
Yeah. We go to Susan next from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Hi.
My question relates to local critical incident stress management teams that have formed to offer assistance in other types of traumatic events like traffic accidents or home fires or explosions. We have a team that's been trained in Dar County to provide that kind of critical incident stress debriefing. So can these local teams offer some sort of support role for what the military is able to provide to returning soldiers, or is the unique nature of war-related PTSD so different from the types of trauma that we might be focusing on, that we would be better served to keep our hands off that? And I'll take my answer on the air. Thank you.
Thank you. On the air, off the air, you mean? Okay. Thanks, Susan, very much for the call. Dr. Smith?
Yeah. In my view, PTSD is PTSD. So, you know, whether you're treating somebody who has PTSD from a traffic accident versus PTSD from war trauma, the underlying issue is generally the same. The treatments are often the same. The particular dilemmas that people have are different. Oftentimes with a traffic accident, it sort of depends on the nature of the accident, but there's not this interpersonal dilemma that often happens in war, which is we're social creatures. And if other people are perceived as dangerous, not trustworthy, it creates a dilemma because we're supposed to live in the world with people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's much easier to treat PTSD from a traffic accident than it would be if you've had several tours if you felt undermined by your colleagues, those kinds of things.
Thanks for the call. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. It's such a troubling story. It's all troubling, but
it is.
You know, thank you. Our thanks to Dr. Tracy Smith, Program Manager of the Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Clinical Team and the lead psychologist at the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital in Madison. Her research focuses on post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Michelle Cornett, clinical psychologist, suicide prevention team leader at the Zablocki VA Medical Center here in Milwaukee. And she has help to expand programming for returning vets and also expanded programs on substance abuse treatment. We thank them for being with us. And we will, of course, this story will go on as congressional hearings begin into the nature of who the person was who did these horrendous killings. So look to more shows next week. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this very good hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production. We'll be with you again in a moment.